Musaviri is the Persian and South Asian miniature art form, traditionally rooted in illustrating life and its intricacies. A skilled Musavir herself, my guest today believes that no canvas is too small. In fact, it's sometimes in the unseen that artists tell their stories. Welcome back to SBS Spice. I'm Suhaila Sharif. If you're fresh to SBS Spice, you can find us wherever you find your podcasts. Mixed medium artist Nusra Latif Qureshi grasps her tools in one hand and history in the other. Born in Lahore, Pakistan, and having lived in Melbourne since 2001, Nusra's 30-year journey with art has been transformative and largely self-sustained.
I believe sitting with what you have and identifying what you carry with you across borders is quite important. And history is one part of that process, or studying history or interacting, engaging with history, gives you not an understanding, but an awareness of where things sit.
Nusra's works can be considered portals to the past, as she invites South Asian viewers to rediscover, reclaim, and unpack history. So it's fitting for me to sit down with her within the walls of her first major solo exhibition, as she shared how history has helped continue a career where she can paint, photograph, and collect the kaleidoscope colouring the art of tomorrow. Nusra, thank you so much for joining me today for SBS Spice. We're here today at the Art Gallery of New South Wales in Sydney, seated in the midst of your first major solo exhibition, Birds and Far Pavilions. Congratulations on the installation and for reaching an incredible milestone of 30 years as an artist. I just have to ask, like, how does it feel to be here today in an exhibition that also celebrates your extensive career?
I think, first of all, my just set sense of wonder, 30 years, I must be really old then. 30 years. Well, thank you, Suhaila, for talking to me about my exhibition. It's a really exciting project that has been more than a year in the making. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of time to put something like this together. So in terms of when and how the works came together, they were in different collections and in different places, sometimes different cities and countries. So we asked quite a few people to lend the works, lend the paintings. And then I did an installation which is based on drawing objects from the collection of the art gallery and also borrowing some objects from the Powerhouse Museum. And the rest of the objects or things or stuff, as I like to call it, the stuff, it came from my studio. I have been collecting many objects which might be able to tell certain stories. And it was very important for me to bring those together with the objects from the art gallery's collection, which are historical objects. And I chose those which spoke to me the loudest, because of their color, because of their histories, their geographies, and some emotional associations, some personal associations. So it became an exercise in actually doing the work in the gallery space. And it also became a studio for a couple of weeks where I was actually placing the objects in the showcases to make them tell certain stories or to arrange them in a way that address certain cultural anxieties even, and point out certain histories, certain forgotten parts of our histories. And I'm talking about colonial history and through that many personal histories.
Amazing. I just had a walk around and already I'm drawn by so many different things here. You're a mixed medium artist, so you're able to, I see it as like a symphony of your soul as an artist to have all these different works here come together. But your particular interest as well here today is Musafiri. And to be completely honest with you, I'd actually never heard of the term as an art form before speaking to you. So for our listeners who may not be familiar with what Musafiri is, could you please explain a little bit about its history, what it looks like, and how you got involved with such an incredible art form?
So the reason I use the term Musaviri instead of miniature painting, it's a subversive act. I wanted to challenge this perception that miniature painting describes how amazing that art practice is, which is based on a painting tradition from South Asia that started in Persian courts, then it moved to Mughal courts, and with a mix of the local painting traditions, you have this beautiful outcome, which is the practice of musawwiri, which is usually described as miniature painting by art historians from the last century and a bit earlier. So I thought that it is misleading, and the word miniature makes you think of toy soldiers or something that is diminished.
Yeah.
And a practice like this, which is incredibly rich history and its potential to address a huge variety of subjects, cannot be diminished. So I started using this term in my master's thesis, and which was about 20 years ago. And I have tried to substitute the term miniature painting with musawwiri, which just translates as painting or an act of painting. And it's a much better and much more dignified term to be used for that historical art practice.
Mm. I think the difference between the two terms being, one being musawwiri and the other being miniature painting, for me, as someone who isn't familiar with that, like, I visualize that, you know, the size, the miniature aspect of it can sometimes limit the artist to be working within that space. But I feel like your musawwiri work illustrates a bigger picture in the sense of where your history is and who you are as an artist, and also the context that you are bringing to life through this work, and particularly a post-colonial context. And for us South Asians, we're in a period where it's about both healing and resisting against the or from the powers that once bound us or oppressed us, essentially. So art can be a landscape that is very, very freeing. And again, going back to the idea of healing, how has working with musawwiri art helped you heal as a South Asian artist?
When I started studying this technique or tradition, it was unfamiliar to me as well when I studied it in Pakistan, because this practice had experienced a disruption because of colonization. And artists had started doing, in the 150 to 200 years, they had started doing other things. For example, working in photography studios when photography almost took over painting in South Asia. And photography had a really early arrival in pre-partition India. So it was almost instant. And lots of photography studios opened up, commercial photography studios, where many of these artists were employed as coloring or retouching. So their skills came in handy, but then it went through a transformation. And for a very long period of time, you did not see them practicing, or they did not have enough patronage to do lots of work. And by the time Pakistan came into being, there were hardly any painters, or very few migrated to Pakistan. And then on top of that, they were not part of the mainstream art world, which was heavily interested in and focused on Western art practices or Westernized art practices. Lots of oil painting, lots of sculpture in the sense that we understand in a, let's say, a Victorian art school or institution, where you are making huge things, you are making large oils. We're talking about early 20th century influences. We're talking about expressionists and impressionists and surrealists. So all those were influencing the artists in South Asia. And in art schools, there was a heavy emphasis on that kind of practice. So nobody paid any attention to what was happening in musawwiri. And in the 1980s, which is such a huge gap, it was introduced as one other elective or a subject for students to study. And again, there was lots of resistance about, it's not modern enough. It does not go with the ideology of a new nation state. So this obsession with nationhood and how we make its new identity in the world, what do we present to the world? So miniature painting or musawwiri tradition did not fit in with that agenda at all, because it represented the old, it represented the past, and perhaps a loss as well, which was not on the list of things to be admitted or talked about.
Yeah.
And that's a very South Asian habit. We don't talk about the losses, the tragedies, the traumas. We just sit on them. So that was one thing that was quite pronounced when I was studying. that there is this gap, there is this loss, or all sometimes intentional or unintentional amnesia, a collective amnesia about this practice. But then as a student, along with many others, saw that this technique has the potential to express a lot of complex emotions and situations and scenarios. And it has a very strong narrative quality, which one can tap into. And that does not only come through technique, but also through a certain sensibility. So that sensibility is very important, and you can carry it anywhere you are, wherever you are born, wherever you are living, and you can carry that sensibility. It's what possibly your true cultural identity, how you speak about things. Sometimes not even, you don't even have to speak that language, but it's the way of expressing things, the way you structure your thoughts, the way you present them to the world or share them. That is the sensibility that I've learned from that tradition. And that is important to me.
Amazing. I think the idea of history, bearing the pain and the losses, but also revisiting history, kind of brings to life how those who lived during that period where that art form, for example, was at its most alive or in its brightest state, teaches you more about how we should continue healing or learn from the past to move forward, I guess. So I think revisiting art forms like this to bring new life to them not only allows you to do justice to what those who before you did, but also breathe new life into those art forms as you do as an artist and as an individual. So what has revisiting history taught you about what the future of South Asian art will look like?
I believe sitting with what you have and identifying what you carry with you across borders is quite important. And history is one part of that process, or studying history or interacting, engaging with history, gives you not an understanding, but an awareness of where things sit. And when you realize where those heavy masses of unresolved issues are sitting, you try to find your way around them. You try to engage with them as an artist. That opens up, of course, lots of Pandora's boxes. There are lots of boxes, lots of cans of worms. But what it also does is enrich you. It helps you grow as a person, and it helps you grow as an artist. And it's always enriching to engage with those histories, and they somehow, somewhere form your vocabulary. You start to engage with those elements that have been sitting unaddressed by other parts of society or other individuals or other segments of society who did not want to engage with those and found them too difficult. And artists, I believe, they don't have a duty, but through training, they have this capacity to open them up and make them tangible, make them approachable for the rest of the people. And that is where art plays its role. I'm not sure what my art is doing, but I attempt to address those silences or those unopened boxes, or if I'm allowed to use a term, portly, that you just tie things up, which our grandmothers and mothers were so fond of. They didn't have boxes. They would tie something up in a piece of fabric, and it would be a beautiful assimilation or assortment of thoughts and ideas and sometimes emotions. And then when it was opened ceremoniously a year later, as a child, you would wait for that opening and see what comes out of that. Mm. Maybe a dress that has been saved for a granddaughter, a wedding dress or something, or somebody's letters, the person who is not there anymore. So that act of engaging with personal histories is very similar to engaging with these unpleasant colonial histories as well, that you don't know what you will find there, but it's always a deeply emotional exercise which helps in healing a person and a group of people as well.
I love how you use a portly as an example or as a reference, because for me, I completely see and visualize what you're saying. And, you know, as you open different portlies, as you mentioned, like, no matter what artist what the artist does each time someone opens a Portly, it's a different experience for them. And it's a different understanding of what exactly they're unboxing there. Mm. And a lot of your work is very introspective. Like this lovely piece at the the outside of the exhibition is your passport photo layered with different figures and art. And introspection also brings out a sense of vulnerability, right? So how do you approach vulnerability as an artist if you're putting so much of yourself into your work?
Well, to be an artist is to be vulnerable all the time. You have to be open to whatever the world is throwing at you constantly, because you have to engage with all that in order to respond to it. So you can't close off. You can't protect yourself. It's like part of the job, or it's a hazard or a work hazard, let's say, that you have to accept when you decide to become an artist and you realize a few years later that, yes, you have to be open. You can't close off ever. Even if you intentionally try, you have to keep yourself, I think, exposed to everything that is happening around you. You can be selective, of course, mm-hmm. and you can choose to take certain parts of that exposure into the studio practice, but then you have to be like fully aware of what is going on all around you. But then each artist has their own interest. Some are interested in political history. Some are interested in what leaves look like. Some are interested in what is going on inside our brains. So everybody has their own interest, but then all of them are engaging and open and absorbing constantly. So it is part of that job description that, yes, you are vulnerable emotionally. Mm-hmm. You have to accumulate a lot. You have to hold a lot of emotions. You have to hold a lot of visual information. And then out of that, all that accumulation, you create experiences that are relatable to other people. And a lot of times that processing is never shared with the outside world. It is never shared in exhibitions. Artists' notebooks, drawings, lots of paintings, they stay in the studio or the creative space. They never make it out, because that process is important. That's where the emotions are harnessed or dealt with or fought with. And what you see on exhibition, in exhibition spaces, is a refined version of what has happened in the studio, or a version that is legible to the viewer visually.
Mm. I mean, we're sitting here in what seems like a world where you've been able to combine the historical and the contemporary. And like you said, being vulnerable is also the flip side to it, is you're inviting people to create this dialogue with you as an artist and create conversations and actually interact with you as they see each and every one of your pieces. So wrapping up, I would love for you to talk more about the kinds of dialogues you hope to create with the work. And as you invite audiences, viewers into this world here, where your work is exhibited, what kind of conversations do you hope they carry back with them once they leave?
I'm very aware of my position as an artist. I'm not unique. I'm not doing anything unusual or original. All artists strive to do something very special in their own way, and they are unique. And that is the special thing about visual arts. They're speaking their own languages. They're saying their own, telling their own stories or sharing their own stories, and which is particular to each artist. What I'm trying to do is perhaps inviting viewers, people, to look a little bit more deeply, to look with a bit more deliberation and engage with the work visually, fully believing that each one of us is capable of understanding any painting, any artwork, without any art training or explanation, that we learn to look and paint first before we developed a written and spoken language. So believing in that, I hope that people get to engage with my work and perhaps find themselves somewhere, some part of themselves. And particularly in relation to the Museum of Lost Memories, which is that huge installation, have a sense of encounter, a cultural encounter, something unfamiliar, but also many familiar things, something that is said directly, but a lot of things that are just implied and left open for the viewer to read in their own time. Maybe they visited the exhibition today, but maybe they will connect those two segments that I've left them in those showcases, and that connection happens a few weeks later. And that is a wonderful moment, that it has meant something for somebody and it has been sitting with them and they were able to make some connection.
Amazing. As someone who is still finding their feet in the art world, I wasn't someone who grew up being an art aficionado, but now as I've grown older, I've been able to appreciate it. So it is a privilege for me to be here to see all your work and, you know, hear about how personal it is to you, but also how welcome you are to people seeing it and taking away what they want from it. I think it's absolutely amazing. My final question for you, since we are celebrating 30 years of your career, I would love for you to share a reflection on what were you like as an artist and what have you learned from starting back 30 years ago and to today? What do you think is the biggest difference in how you approach art and why you do what you do?
Oh, it's, I think some of us become very clear quite early about other things not working for them. I wasn't interested in science, maths, anything else in school. And we did not have art in our school as a subject. But then I was doing it on my own. And I was encouraged at home. So after high school, I was able to choose whatever I wanted to study. And I chose to study fine arts, which I'm really grateful for to my parents that they let me make that choice. And in South Asian Connections particularly, you would understand the pain of you have to study this, you have to study science, you have to become this, you have
100%.
To become that. So that lots of pressure, which fortunately I did not get from my family. And I was free to choose what I wanted to study. And I've been, I think, lucky enough to study art at National College of Arts and before that at another institution, the Hall College for Women, which had an amazing art department. So I've been, I think, extremely fortunate in all those stages of my training where I got really good teachers who were very supportive and the criticism was very supportive as well. And we were allowed to explore despite having very strong and very focused training, which was sometimes drove us to tears, but it was good. It was good to have that training to be able to understand how other disciplines work. So we studied sculpture, we studied architectural drafting, we studied design. So it was a really good foundation. We studied art history from all over the world, not just from that region or not just Western art history, but everywhere, spanning a long period of time. So then it covered a lot of bases. And that has helped me grow and many of my fellow artists who trained at that time. And I think that's possibly a kind of a sad difference that I see sometimes, that even though we have all this access now through internet, we do not try to learn about what's happening in other parts of the world or other histories. And we accept the, I think, watered down versions of art practices and art histories as the real thing. So Picasso is done to death. Let go of him. Please try and discover Nan Suk, who was practicing in Pahari school in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, and that family, who were all artists, and they did incredible works. So being specific, being focused is very important, but to know all the other histories is very important too. And that helps you ground yourself as a person and as an artist.
Thank you for sharing that with us. And of course, 30 years now, but we can't wait to see where the journey takes you after this. Nusrat, thank you so much for joining me today for SBS Spice.
Thank you, Suhaila. It has been wonderful speaking to you.
And that was Nusra. I hope you enjoyed the episode and thank you so much for joining us. If you like our stories, share them with your friends. Subscribe to SBS Spice wherever you get your podcasts and never miss an update. Find and follow us on Instagram at SBS Spice for explainers and pop culture patrols. If you're a YouTube person, you can also find us by searching for SBS Spice. We'll be back soon with another Chili in the Pod to see what makes South Asians tick or ick.